Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I am sad to say I don't have any comments to read to you today. So for all of those that are out there listening, and I know you are, make sure you send some comments in on these programs. Now, to refresh our memory of the lead up to Dunkirk, let's go back and summarize the events in England and Europe in the summer and fall of 1939. Now, Mr. Stephen Fleury has been covering some of this in detail on the Trumpet Daily, but it really fits in with this program as well, and so I think it's very important to repeat it. Now, the big thing that was happening in 1939 in the midsummer is in Britain, although very slowly at first, the opinion was moving away from the Munich Appeasement Pact that Neville Chamberlain had brokered with Hitler. Now, it was an amazing time at that time. And as Manchester brings out, and Mr. Stephen Fleury has brought it out on the Trumpet Daily, is the leaders of government were actually lying to the people. They were actually concealing facts. They were hiding the truth. They were really working hard at getting this peace pact with Hitler, and they were denying what Hitler was doing. And there were other people that knew what was going, and of course we even brought out in this program before that Winston Churchill was getting top secret documents handed to him that showed him that Britain was just in really bad straits, certainly militarily. But in January 1939, Hitler had set out to build an immense fleet of battleships. He has plans for 3 battlecruisers, 4 aircraft carriers, and about, 249, maybe 250 submarines. Now, some of the people that had knowledge of this considered this a declaration of war. But still, the people were, they were still lulled to sleep. They really believed they could make a peace pact with Hitler and save the empire that way. It was really crazy. And Manchester really does bring out a lot about this and how crazy the thinking was in England, and it was just they were so out of touch with reality, with what was really going on in the world. Now, again, when Hitler decided that he was going to build this massive army, that was against the Versailles Treaty, and it really should have had England riled up. Now, just after Munich, after the Munich Peace Pact, when Chamberlain came back and everybody was absolutely cheering that he had gotten peace. And remember, part of the deal was to let Hitler go in and take the Sudetenland, which was primarily German-speaking. And if you remember, if you remember some of the history, even maybe from the Trumpet Daily, what Hitler and the Germans were doing is they were stirring up this controversy that the Czechoslovakian people were persecuting the Germans in the Sudetenland. That wasn't going on at all. But Hitler knew how to work, mass media. He knew how to work it to his advantage. And what happened then is Churchill warned, after Munich, then Churchill had warned that Hitler would take all of Czechoslovakia. And of course, he did that in March 1939. Then he also began to threaten Poland. Now, because he was starting to threaten Poland, that really did get people stirred up because, according to the Warsaw Pact, Britain had the agreement that they would protect Poland from invasion. Now, what happened then is, in August 1939, Hitler and Stalin signed this incredible peace pact, or this pact, between the two of them to divide Poland. And again, you know, that's a very famous pact in history. And we've talked on Trumpet and even at thetrumpet.com about, we suspect there are now pacts also being signed by the German government today in Russia. So things are kind of lining up for history to repeat itself. Now, again, what happened then is Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939. So essentially what had to happen then is Britain and France had to declare war on Germany. So they actually did declare war 2 days later. And as Paul Johnson states, Poland was then swallowed up by two totalitarian powers in 1 month. Now, that was just really, it was shocking for the world, but still, it was even shocking to some in Britain, but still, it was hard to get Britain, you know, fired up. Now, essentially then what happened after that is that there was some real advertisement. I think Mr. Stephen Fleury has talked about this on the Trumpet Daily, that there was one person advertising, let's get Winston Churchill back. I mean, that was just popular advertising at that time. And then also, if you really have the opportunity to read this Manchester series, you're going to see that both Halifax and Chamberlain actually wanted to bring Churchill back to the government to make him a fall guy again. And remember, even though during these 10 years where he was supposedly in the wilderness, I mean, Winston Churchill was still an MP and he still had the opportunity to go out and talk to the people. And he was warning about what was happening in Germany, what was happening in Europe. And, people were not always listening to him. But actually, Halifax, he decided not to get to, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I don't want to get too far ahead. But anyway, what happened then is Neville Chamberlain restored Winston Churchill to the office of the first Lord of the Admiralty in that same month, September 1939. And he put him on the War Cabinet of Six. And so if you remember about this time, and we've discussed this in the past, in past programs, is if you remember, you know, during this time, Winston Churchill had lost his fortune. Winston Churchill had been injured on one of the streets in New York City. I mean, he had really gone through some rough times. And when he came back, I mean, he was an older man. And he looked older, and people still thought he was all washed up. But really, I'm going to turn back here to Paul Johnson here for a minute. But actually, this invigorated Winston Churchill. This really encouraged him. And he actually went back and worked as hard as he did previously when he was first Lord of the Admiralty years and years ago. That was right before World War I. So if you have your books out there, or if you're just listening, you can turn to your book later. But I want to start at page 103 of Johnson and just read to you a section that once, here's what Winston Churchill wrote in his journal after they had put him back in as first Lord of the Admiralty. Oh, maybe I'll just start at the top, and this will talk about that advertising agent as well. So I'm at the top of the page. It says, since July, and we're talking about July 1939, enormous and puzzling posters had appeared on prominent London sites asking in giant letters, what price Churchill? The man responsible, an advertising agent, later said, I wanted to get people thinking about the reinstatement of Churchill. In fact, it happened swiftly once war was declared. Churchill was invited to accept his old post of First Lord of the Admiralty, and he did together with a seat in a War Cabinet of Six. He wrote, this is what Churchill wrote in his diary, a very strong sense of calm came over me after the intense passions and excitements of the last few days. I felt a serenity of mind and was conscious of a kind of uplifted detachment from human and personal affairs. Now, in some ways, like I said, he had some really tough go of it. But now, all of that was like off of his shoulders. Now, here's what Johnson says at the bottom of the page. He says, despite rumors by his enemies that he was looking old and past it, Churchill worked fanatically hard. Out on inspections most days, naval conference from 9 to 11, then dictating late into the night. On September 24th, he recorded, "During the last 3 weeks, I have not had a minute to think of anything but my task. They are the longest 3 weeks I have lived." Clemmy, and we know that's his wife, Clementine, wrote, "Winston works night and day. He is well, thank God, and gets tired only if he does not get 8 hours sleep. He does not need it at a stretch, but if he does not get that amount in the 24 hours, he gets weary." One of his staff, Kathleen Hill, testified, "When Winston was at the Admiralty, the place was buzzing with atmosphere and with electricity. When he was away on tour, it was dead, dead, dead." On September 26, he made his first big speech since returning to office. It was a notable success. Harold Nicholson, the parliamentary diarist, recorded, "His delivery was really amazing, and he sounded every note from the deep preoccupation to flippancy, from resolution to sheer boyishness. One could feel the spirits of the House rising with every word." And so you could see that here, Churchill really was back. He was a leader. He was a leader of men. But the problem is, even though he was back at first Lord of the Admiralty, he didn't really have a whole lot of power. And remember, this period now from the time of September 1st, when Hitler went in and took Poland. Remember, there was this horrible winter then, right after that, and it was so bad. I mean, it was this freezing temperatures, a lot of snow, and everybody slipped into this whole atmosphere that there really wasn't war. And really, the only reason why Hitler did not make more moves, it was too cold. And you remember at that time, the tank was relatively new. The vehicles were relatively, maybe weren't as sophisticated as they are today, so they were subject to freezing. And the tanks just couldn't work as well, you know, in very cold conditions. And so everyone kind of slumbered to sleep, and I know we talked about this on the last program, that early winter of 1940, so the late 1939, early 1940, in March, it finally all broke, and this is March 1940, it all broke, and it was the most beautiful spring in England, the most beautiful spring in Europe, and people really believed that they could just get in there and, they had a blockade against Germany. They thought they could win the war with a blockade, and it was just really kind of a crazy time. But here's what Johnson says about this. He says, "Hard as Churchill worked, however, he had little power in the general conduct of the war, which languished in activity. It was known as the phony war, leaving the initiative to Hitler. In April 1940, the Nazis struck at Denmark and Norway, and in May at Holland and Belgium. None put up a fight. The British intervention in Norway was a failure despite Churchill's efforts. The army proved no good at combined operations, as the RAF could not operate so far from its bases, and the Germans controlled the air. German naval losses were heavy, 3 cruisers and 10 destroyers lost, 2 heavy cruisers and a pocket of battleships put out of action. This had the effect later in the summer of helping to dissuade Hitler from a direct invasion of England. On the other hand, in the long term, it meant virtually the whole of the western coast of Europe was available for U-boat bases." So in some ways, everybody was lulled to sleep. Even Hitler was affected by it. But the problem is, it was soon going to change. Now, here's what, I guess maybe I could just summarize this a little bit. in England then, after the fall of Norway and after the fall of Denmark, there's the very famous May 7th through 8th, 1940 Commons. It's called the Norway debate. And that's when people realized Chamberlain had to go. And, you know, they had to get rid of him. And the only person making sense of that time was Winston Churchill. And so the tide began to turn in his favor. Here's what Jonathan says at the bottom of page 105. He says, Chamberlain decided to resign. It now became obvious there would have to be an all-party coalition. Labor made it clear it would accept only Halifax or Churchill as leader. Churchill, for once, kept his mouth shut and let others do the talking. King George VI, a conventional man brought up to regard Churchill as a menace, favored Halifax, the establishment candidate, but Halifax ruled himself out. He could not, he said, run a crisis government from the House of Lords. And what Manchester brings out is that was the public reason why Halifax denied it. But essentially what Halifax wanted was Churchill to get in, make mistakes, and then he would really lose favor again, and then Halifax would come in and save the day. Now that's what Manchester says. Now, by 6 p.m. on Friday, May 10th, Churchill got the job he had worked for. 12 hours earlier, the Germans had begun the decisive campaign against France. Early reports were as bad as Churchill was forming his cabinet. He did not go to bed till 3 a.m., but his courage was high, he recorded. So eventually, even the king, everybody agreed that only Churchill was going to be able to form the government. And actually, Churchill now was back in as prime minister. And here's what he wrote. And again, this is so famous, but it's just really important. I think it's really good that we talk about this right before we get into this situation at Dunkirk. Here's what Churchill wrote. He says, "I was conscious of a profound sense of relief. At last, I had authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. 10 years in the political wilderness had freed me from ordinary party antagonisms." That's an astounding statement. He could have looked at those wilderness years. You know, he did fight what he called the black dog. He did miss being in the political limelight, but he was being prepared. He was now above party antagonisms, and he could really devote his attention to saving England and Britain, really, and the whole Western world. He says, "My warnings over the past 6 years have been so numerous, so detailed, and were now so terribly vindicated that no one could gainsay me. I could not be reproached either for making the war or with want of preparations for it. I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure I would not fail. Therefore, although impatient for this morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams." So I think that's of course, he's a great writer. But the thing that was really good, again, I want to repeat this sentence. Listen to what he said. "I could not be reproached either for making the war or with want of preparation for it." And so really, in that statement, I don't know when this was really publicized, but he's really slapping Chamberlain and Halifax in the face because they did not prepare for the war. And here Hitler was out preparing for it. They knew he was preparing for it, and they did nothing. So Churchill now came on the scene at an extremely grave time for England and the West. Now, it's interesting. In 2017, there was a movie called Dunkirk, and it was written by, I think, John Nolan. And, of course, then in 2018, then we just had the movie The Darkest Hour. And I know Mr. Stephen Fleury has talked about it on the Trumpet Daily quite extensively. And I am going to use, as we go through this, I am going to use a couple pages out of the book by Anthony McCartan. And I'm also going to read you part of the epilogue because we don't agree with that book. There was never a time that Churchill wanted to agree with the appeasers. And there was never a time when Churchill wanted to submit or surrender to Hitler. And even Hitler knew that. I mean, even Hitler understood that Churchill was a warrior. And in fact, I don't think Hitler actually really wanted to tangle with Churchill. And so these subjects have been out there in the public, and I think that maybe with these programs we can clear up a few of the misunderstandings. So today, what we want to do is begin our discussion of the miracles at Dunkirk. Now, back with me in the studio today is my best mate, and that's for all you Aussies that are listening, and partner in literature. She's also my wife, Deborah Leaf. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Well, you're finally off vacation.
That's right.
I've been here all by myself.
I've been listening.
Oh, so you've been listening to the series. So
I
what
have,
do you think?
Yes. Well, it's really good for those of us who have not had time to read The Last Lion. You're talking about Manchester.
Oh, yeah.
I really do want to read it. I mean, like I said before, I like the Johnson book is short, and it's easy for those of us who may not have time to read a long book. But reading a long book is really valuable, and it's kind of piqued my interest even more so in the Manchester book, The Last Lion. So I think it's been very interesting.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, the thing is we don't want to fault Paul Johnson, because I think it's a great book and it serves a good purpose. But also, William Manchester just has a way of writing the drama. And in fact, Paul Johnson, I mean, as we'll see here in a minute, he actually skips over Dunkirk. He doesn't even mention it hardly at all. And so, this is where we have to go back to something else. And again, I think it's important that we just tie everything together for everybody. So, let's do this. I talked a little bit about the films. Let's begin talking about Operation Dynamo. And this was the technical name for what happened at Dunkirk. Now, again, Manchester gives us kind of a really critical view. He gives us a true view, and it's really kind of shocking what was still going on in the nation at the time, and I'll be able to bring this out. But we're actually into the third volume now, and this is the volume that Paul Reed. Manchester died before he could complete this, and Paul Reed had to help him finish it. But this is called The Last Lion, and of course there's a subtitle, Winston Spencer Churchill, Defender of the Realm. And this goes from 1940 to 1965. So there's an awful lot in the book, but I want to just read to you a little bit how he describes the lead up to Dunkirk. Now, you have to understand, there's a lot of things related to Dunkirk that we can't certainly discuss, you know, in two radio programs or three radio programs. And there's a lot of things that were going on, let's say, with what Hitler was doing in Denmark and Belgium and France. And, but the thing that we want you to understand from this is that Winston Churchill was put into an incredibly difficult situation because the Allies were losing. They were immediately losing. And in fact, here's how he describes it on page 73. And this is William Manchester. This is the fourth version, Winston Churchill, Defender of the Realm, or the third volume. He goes on, and this is talking about the situation that Churchill entered into. He said, it was more than grave. It was catastrophic. Now all France, like ancient Gaul, was divided into three parts. And what he's referring to here is Hitler and his blitzkrieg. And if you remember, Hitler really didn't have a lot of war materials behind him. He really was not as prepared as he wanted to be. That's why there was that eight-month lull, during that really harsh winter of 1939, end of fall of 1939 and the beginning of 1940. But he had developed, you go in there, you terrorize them, you tear it up, and then you can cause people to surrender. And that's what was happening in France. Now, let me just continue reading here. In the south, below the Somme, where Wagen actually planned to make a stand, lay 90% of France, including Paris. It was no longer the serene France of those early spring days. However, Spears reported that the roads were choked with refugees, top-heavy wagons, and cars with boiling radiators. Over 300,000 Polis, members of military formations which no longer existed, were roaming the countryside. Some, he reported, had shot their officers and were robbing passersby in the forest near Paris. French officers, captured by the Germans, but given their parole, had returned to their homes, seemed to be enjoying their families, and weren't even interested in news of the fighting. In the north, a desperate amalgam of Allied forces, more than half of the BEF, or the British forces, and the Belgians, and the three French armies, was fighting for survival. Between the two, a broadening, solidifying belt of enemy territory stretched across France from the Sedan in the east to Abbeville on the coast. Capturing Paris was every German's dream, and the panzers could have turned that way. Well, we're out of time for this program, so we'll continue this next time. But remember, our next book in this series, also by Paul Johnson, is titled George Washington, Founding Father. And our third book in this series is Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can find both those books on Amazon. You can find used copies of the books at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to JBL at pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.